For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host, Red Sail, and coming up this week, we're featuring some fantastic reads for the long summer holidays. We explore some great titles from the RNIB Library's Summer Reading Challenge.
I can't believe it! That's how he keeps disappearing. Playground dog can fly.
Paola Peretti explains how her own sight loss inspired her beautiful debut novel for children, The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree.
The disease helped me to write the book. And I think it's been a therapy to me, writing this book.
The book's narrator, Rosie Ackerman, reveals the effect it had on her.
I thought it was beautiful. It actually made me cry in a couple of parts.
The book's translator, Denise Muir, reveals the tricks of her trade.
Be sensitive to what you're reading and the sounds of the words, the meanings of the words, the voice of the author.
And the book's editor and publisher tells us why she feels The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree is a book that had to be published.
If by any chance these same children, these same readers do come across a character in real life who has a similar situation, they will feel more comfortable in reassuring them perhaps or supporting them because they've already met them before within the pages of a book.
That's all coming up on today's Read On. This week sees the publication of a book for children that is already being hailed as a modern classic. The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree by Paola Peretti tells the story of 9-year-old Mafalda, who knows that she will lose her sight completely within the next 6 months. Can she find a way through a seemingly dark future and still go to school, play football, and look after her beloved cat? With the help of her family and friends, Mafalda needs to discover the things that will be important to her once her sight has gone. The book was inspired by the author's own story. Paola Peretti learnt that she had Stargardt's disease 15 years ago, and she, like Mafalda, lives in Italy. But she was in London for the book's UK publication, and to visit the RNIB studios where the English language version of the audiobook was being recorded.
All children are scared of the dark. The dark is a room with no door and no windows, where monsters grab you and eat you without making a sound. I'm not afraid of the dark, though. But I have something else to worry about. I have my very own dark. The one in my eyes. I'm not making it up. If I were, Mum wouldn't buy me pastries shaped like peaches filled with cream, and she wouldn't let me eat them before dinner. If everything were okay, Dad wouldn't hide in the bathroom when the landlady phones, because it's always bad news when she rings.
Rosie Ackerman narrating The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree by my guest, Paola Peretti. Paola Peretti, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
The book is published this week, and I've been lucky enough to read it already. But for listeners who haven't, could you take us into the world of Mafalda?
Mafalda is a 9-year-old girl who finds out that she suffers from a serious disease. She is losing her sight. And in 6 months, she will go in blind. So she starts having a list of what she can do and what she can't do anymore.
And the book is very much about her coming to terms with what she's losing and trying to see what is essential.
Yeah, is in this way, yeah. I think she will find what is essential for her only through a process along all the book. And at the end, maybe she will find it.
Storytelling is also very important. The books that help her are The Little Prince and also a book called The Baron in the Trees.
The Baron in the Trees is her father's favorite book. And the story of Mafalda is also based on this real novel written by Italo Calvino, an Italian writer. Yeah, there's also The Little Prince. I think it's a book that we can read at all ages.
And I felt very much the same about your book. The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree is a book for children, but it's also a book for adults. It's about learning to live with loss and becoming independent of the grief that you suffer with loss.
Oh, thank you for this question. And yes, it's a book about losing something and gaining something else. Strength. I think that Mafalda is finding her identity through this losing. So, I think so.
And it's also she finds her identity, but not necessarily with the help of her parents. It's more, or her school. It's more the help from unexpected places, the Romanian caretaker at the school and the bad boy at the school.
Yes. The parents are worried and scared about her future, and I think she tries to protect them. Estella and Filippo, the bad boy, are marginalized people, and I really liked this kind of purse of people because I think they are very sensitive and creative when you get close to them.
And they also speak the truth. The truth might not always be pleasant, but Mafalda has to realize that she will be blind and that she will have to have independence in a very different way. And it's only when Filippo or Estella points that out to her that she comes to terms with it. Her parents are scared, so they almost sidestep the issue.
Yeah, I think that saying the truth is very, very important. Maybe it's not easy to accept, but this is the real life, so Mafalda has to accept it. And in this way, she can start finding another way of thinking, an alternative way of thinking about everything. Only in this way, I think, she can find her instruments, alternative instruments, to do what she wanted to do.
Don't worry, Mum says when she does the dishes after dinner. Go and play in your room, and don't worry about a thing. I hesitate in the kitchen doorway, trying with the power of my mind to make her turn around, but it never works. So here I am in my room, cuddling Ottimo Tukuret, my brown and grey cat with a kink at the end of his tail. He doesn't mind being lifted, rolled over on the carpet or chased with the toilet brush. He's a cat, Dad says, and cats are opportunists. I suppose that means they like attention.
The book is very realistic. It's clearly informed by your own experience of losing your sight, but it's also got some rather magical realism. Do you like mixing the imagination of magical realism with a real story?
Oh, yeah, I really like doing it, yes. I usually do it in my life. And I think that the tree is the perfect metaphor in this sense, because it's a real thing, but it represents also a place of imagination, of fantasy for Mafalda. Mafalda is in part is fiction, but in part is a piece of my story.
Has your own Stargardt disease made you into a writer, do you think?
I've ever wanted to be a writer and to become a writer as a work. So the disease didn't bring me to this work, but the disease helped me to write the book. And I think it's been a therapy to me, writing this book. And it's been also a process to acceptation of the pathology.
Yes, I read a wonderful quote. I want to write, I can't wait any longer. When I write, I have eyes inside my hands that make me see better inside my head, which I thought was a lovely way of expressing what your blindness has done for you as far as your creativity.
Oh, thank you. I think so. Hands are very important to me. Yeah, I'm a writer. I really like the image of having eyes in my hand.
How do you write? Do you type or do you dictate your book?
I type. I've been a journalist, so that work taught to me writing in a very clicky way without looking at the keyboard. It's been very useful. I have a program of magnifying for and I also use a program of reading for verify my dialogue.
Yeah, a sort of text to speech.
Yes.
I use that as well, and actually I find that helps me not write long and boring sentences. It keeps my writing quite tight.
Yeah. Yes, it's useful.
And are you working on another book at the moment?
Yes, I'm working on my second book. And it will be about another boy, a bit older than Mafalda. He is a gypsy boy who is fighting between a stable boy with an apartment and a family in a house, or being a gypsy. He was very happy when he was a gypsy.
Clearly, reading is also very important to you. And we've mentioned The Little Prince, which is the first Braille book that Mafalda receives. And her father's favourite book, The Baron in the Trees, is the first audio book that she listens to. Do you use both Braille and audiobooks to read?
I've never tried reading with Braille, but I will. sometimes I listen to audiobooks, but I prefer using my e-book with a very big font. Now I prefer it.
Have you heard the English language version of your audiobook that was recorded here?
Yeah, I listened to a piece of that version. It was wonderful, I think. Yeah.
So you must be very pleased with the translation that Denise, the translator, has done.
Denise has been a very sensitive translator, and I think she used to read my book to her daughter. So the translation, it's been perfect for children, I think.
Paola Peretti, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and best of luck with what I am sure will be a very long writing career.
Oh, thank you for all. Thank you for all.
For me, it's enough that he's around when things are going wrong, and I need someone warm and cuddly to hug. Like now. I know something's wrong. I might only be in year five, but I notice everything. My cousin's girlfriend says I have a third eye. She's Indian and has a dot painted in the middle of her forehead. I like that she thinks I have an extra eye, although it would be better if the two eyes I already have actually worked. Sometimes I feel like crying, like now. My glasses steam up when I'm about to cry. I take them off, so at least they can dry and the red mark on my nose will go away.
The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree is out this week in paperback, ebook, and audio. And thanks to the publishers Hot Key Press, it simultaneously entered the RNIB library in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB24549.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly, and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come, N.B. Dixon leads us into the thrilling world of the Inkheart trilogy. But first, the young actress chosen to narrate the audiobook version of The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree is Rosie Ackerman. She gave me her verdict and told me more about her life as a voice actress. Rosie, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
So, what did you think of the book?
I thought it was beautiful. It actually made me cry in a couple of parts. It's told from the point of view of a 10-year-old girl who's slowly losing her sight down to a disease called Stargardt disease, where you kind of start to get misty dots over your eyes and they kind of get bigger and bigger to a point where you can't see anymore. And it's really beautifully written. She kind of talks about things from her perspective as a little girl. I feel like the book is something that could appeal not just to young people. Like, I'm not as young as 10 and I really enjoyed it. And I thought that it captured what it's like to be a 10-year-old girl very well, considering it's written by someone who isn't 10 currently. whereas it's also, I imagine, quite a honest telling of what it's like to go through something like that.
How did you come across the book?
So I came across the book through a production company I've worked with before, and I've done a couple of books with them, and they told me about this book that they had, and they wanted a young voice for it because it's told from the perspective of a 10-year-old girl. So yeah, I did a sample recording and they liked what I did, so here I am.
And this isn't the first time that you've worked at RNIB Studios, is it?
No, so I worked here in maybe September last year, recording a book called Remember Me by Linda Renham. Very different book. It's a book that's a psychological thriller about some strange neighbours who move in next door, and you think there's something fishy going on, but you're not really sure what, and then it all comes to a head at the end with a big twist. So very different book.
And this time, actually, you were recording with one of the engineers at RNIB Talking Books, who's blind himself.
Yes, and it was actually really interesting working with him on it because he is someone who was born blind. So I said to him, I didn't know this at the time, and I said, do you relate to a lot of what this girl's saying? And he was like, of course I relate to a 10-year-old girl. but yeah, actually, he was born blind, so the protagonist, Mafalda, she talks a lot about what she's going to miss when she finally goes in the dark and what things are important to her that she wishes she can still be able to see. But he said it's different for him because he's never been able to see. So, but it was interesting hearing what he had to say about it, because he said that he imagines that must be exactly what it's like, and he thinks it's probably a lot harder for people who could originally see and then lose their sight, because for him, all he's ever known is the dark, as Mafalda calls it. So, yeah, no, that was quite interesting for me.
Yes, a rather timely reminder that sight loss isn't one size fits all.
Yeah.
And how did you end up becoming a narrator?
Yeah, so I went to drama school and trained as an actor, and I didn't really know that audiobooks were a thing. I'd kind of heard the phrase, but I didn't know that the actors could be narrators. And when we had, like, in our final year of drama school, we had a radio module, and we covered things like commercials and radio dramas and audiobooks. And I really enjoyed it. And I was told that I had a flair for accents. And I thought, okay, maybe this is a skill that I could flex more often. And so I sort of researched into it after leaving drama school and spoke to an actor, a voiceover actor who does a lot of audiobooks. And he sort of told me all I needed to know. And so I went and did research, contacted a few production companies, made myself a reel. And that's kind of how I got into it, really. And I love doing it. I really, really enjoy it. I really enjoy doing the different voices and knowing that someone is listening along to what I'm saying and kind of getting excitement and entertainment from it. And it's nice that I can bring something to people that they may not normally be able to do, which is really nice.
I've spoken to a few narrators over the years, and I think one thing you all have in common is you are magpies for other people's voices, for accents. Do you find yourself listening to people's conversations on the bus or the tube and thinking, oh, I have that?
A little bit. I think the hardest thing, or what, because I'm kind of new to it, I've only done 5 books, and there are some people that have done hundreds. The thing that I find hardest is when you have a group of characters all from the same area, so you need to give them different voices, but they might all still have the same accent. So it's about finding different parts of your mouth to speak with. And I think that I'm probably not as daring as I could be with accents. And I was actually having a conversation with another voice actor about this when I did a book last year. And she was saying that as you do more, you become more confident with doing voices, because I think sometimes I think, oh, that voice is too silly and it's going to sound ridiculous, like a cartoon character voice. But actually, when the person's listening, they're not thinking that at all. So it's just about being daring. And, you know, we work alongside a producer whenever we record our books. And if I ever did a voice that sounded ridiculous, I'm sure that they would tell me to bring it back a bit. So, yeah.
And you presumably mark up your book script with different colours to remind you of which voice belongs to whom.
Exactly, yeah, that's exactly what I do. So when I get a book come in, I take 2 or 3 days to sit and read it. And as I'm reading it and going through, any new characters that come up, I highlight them in a different colour. And then I just make a note of what their name was and what colour I've given them. And then once I've done that with the whole book, I'll then go back and think, right, what should that person sound like? How have they been described? Sometimes the author might describe them as having a certain kind of voice, or they might not. So they might describe them as like a big, fat, balding man. And so in my head, I think, right, what would a big, fat, balding man sound like? And then a voice just comes from that.
It's strange when when people ask me how I recognise people, I say that everybody has their own resonance. You know, you have tall, slim people who sound more like piccolos or clarinets, and then you have deep, heavy people who might sound a little bit more like a double bass, and you just pick up the difference in resonance, I think.
Yeah, I bet. From their height or their size and all of that.
And it's interesting that you're looking for those same kind of clues within a book to be able to flesh out the voice.
Definitely. And also, a friend of mine who also is a narrator, he said a good thing to do is if, does this character remind you of anyone you know? And then if they do, you can kind of think, right, what do they sound like? And try and do that voice. I think what I struggle with is male voices. And I think it's something that, again, it just comes with experience. The more books you do, the more confident you get with finding the different resonance points in your voice. Just like I'm sure maybe men find it hard to do female voices, I don't know.
I think probably every voice actor has their own likes and dislikes within an audiobook, things
yeah,
that they find easier or more difficult. So if I could offer you any book that you could narrate, is there a dream book that you'd like to take on?
Do you know what? It would probably have to be a Jacqueline Wilson book, only because as a kid, I was glued to those books. I read all of them. So I think that I just feel like that would be, I don't know, it would be a childhood dream, I think, to be able to narrate a Jacqueline Wilson book.
Rosie Ackerman, thank you so much for coming into the studio and being a guest on Read On.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I run my fingers over the edge of the books behind my head, on the shelf above the headboard. I pick up the notebook with the crumpled corner. I lay it on my pillow. The label on the front of it says, Mafalda's List. I use this notebook as my personal organiser. There's a date, 14th of September, on the first page. That was 3 years, 11 days ago. Under that, I've written, things I care a lot about that I won't be able to do anymore. It's not a long list. There are only 3 pages, to tell the truth, and the first one starts with counting the stars in the sky at night, driving a submarine, crossed out, making goodnight light signals at the window. Code red. My glasses have steamed up.
The person charged with translating the distance between me and the cherry tree is Denise Muir, and I was keen to talk to her about the process of translating a book. Denise, welcome to Read On.
Hi there, hi.
So, how do you go about translating a work of literature from one language into another?
Gosh, that's a huge question. I think before you can translate the book, you have to know the culture that you're translating from. So you have to have some sort of experience or grounding with the source language, we call it with Italian. And then you also have to be able to write well in English and be confident and have good ear, I would say, to pick up voices and be sensitive to what you're reading and the sounds of the words, the meanings of the words, the voice of the author. So there's lots of things going on. It's not just about reading the one language and then carrying it straight across into another.
So I'm guessing that you studied Italian at university. Well, I know that you actually share your time between Scotland and Italy, but when you're sent a manuscript, do you actually have to have a love of that manuscript to want to translate the book?
First, to answer the first part of your question, I have no qualifications whatsoever in translation. I am purely experience and practice based. I have a long, as you've said, I have a long sort of connection with Italy. I moved there 20 years ago and have been back and forward ever since. But half my family's Italian, my acquired family, not my original. So yeah, I have life experience with Italy and a love of books, literature. I grew up reading books. I've read books to my daughter. I've read books in the community. I go into libraries, schools. So that's the connection between the two. When a manuscript, that wonderful day when it pops into your inbox, yes, you do. To translate it well, you have to actually love, I think you have to love the book. On occasion, you will be asked to do a sample translation. One or two translators will submit a sample. The publisher will then pick the one that sort of jumps out from the page. So to make your story, your translation jump out from the page the way the original story does, there has to be some sort of emotional connection with it, I think, when you're translating a children's book like Paola's.
Is it important to have spoken to the author themselves so you get a sense of their voice?
It really depends. Obviously, when you're translating a live author, you do have that opportunity, and all translators have their own sort of techniques, methods and sort of situations. I like to have read something about the author, to either have listened to her read her own books at events, to have a sense of who she is, you know, her experience and, you know, where she was coming from when she actually wrote the book, to try, you know, you're having to interpret when you're reading some things, you know, to decide why she chose that word, why it was worded in a certain fashion, or even the themes or what the author was hoping to achieve with what she's written. So yeah, I do like to have a sense of who the author is. You don't always get the chance to meet them. I got the chance to write and correspond with Paola, so that was nice.
In some ways, it's a little bit like the narrators who read the audiobook versions, that you have to have a sense of voice. I felt very strongly that Filippo had a certain way of speaking in the book, yeah. And Mafalda as well. And the narrators will create a voice from their reference library of voices when they're reading the books. But I suppose it's the same when you're translating. Do you kind of almost have their dialect in your head?
Do you know, it depends what kind of book it is you're translating. In Paola's book in particular, I felt it wasn't actually Paola's voice I was translating, it was her character's voices, because there's, as you've mentioned, there's very, very strong characters. They're lovable, they're adorable, they're funny, they're witty, they're quirky, they're deep, they're emotional. Other books you might translate, perhaps if you translate, I've translated an author who is himself a poet, it's his voice I hear when I'm translating his work. But I think in this book, it was just the characters, because they just jump out of the page from you. And I think that was a huge part of the translation process, was trying to make that voice emerge in English so that the English reader got the same experience of that character as the sort of source language readers would experience.
And did you read the book in both Italian and English to your own daughter?
Oh gosh, that's... my daughter is a keen reader but also a lazy reader, and she's very picky. So I leave books around the house. I encourage, but I think she's halfway through. I picked up her copy this morning. I brought it with me. There's a page folded over halfway through, so she hasn't finished yet.
That's a good sign. She's halfway through. Yeah. And you're very much an advocate for strong voices in children's literature, and I believe you've written yourself.
I wouldn't say I've written. I write a blog about Italian children's books. I haven't actually posted for a while because I've been a bit busy. But yeah, if I come across a book which I think excited me, or it had some sort of message, or I've done work in a classroom with it, with children, I've seen children excited or maybe haven't changed through what they've read, I tend to then write a little piece on my blog, which is kind of chatty and it's not highbrow, it's just basically what reactions I got from that book, and it would be so cool if they existed in English.
Is there a strong body of young adult and children's fiction in Italy that's just waiting to be translated?
Do you know, I think there is. There are some good ones, there's some bad ones, and there's some mediocre ones, but the good ones I think are doing something which maybe is not quite as... there's not quite as much of it in English, and I think Paola's book falls into that category. That I think Italian writers, I have discovered in my quest for books to work with children, to take to children in classrooms, and my daughter and I read aloud in libraries, are books that tend to be quite, they've got a good emotional content. They could be dealing with whether it's social themes, whether it's diverse voices, whether it's moral tales, you know, going back to the history of Italian classic children's literature, the big theme. You know, that children can perhaps reflect on issues that we might deem are too deep for them. And I think Italian writers do that really well at the moment. There's writers publishing on all sorts of things, gender issues, on immigration issues, and just putting stories out there that children need to have as part of their experience to learn about. So yeah, there's many, many wonderful books out there.
Well, I hope many more of them come into your inbox, and that you do them equal justice as you have done to The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree.
Oh, thank you very much.
Denise Muir, thank you for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
Grandma used to live across the road from us, in the red house with lace curtains. A young couple lives there now. They never say hello, and have even changed the curtains. Grandma was Dad's mum. She had curly hair like mine, only grey, and would always flash her torch to me before going to bed. One flash meant, "I'm calling you." Two flashes, "Good night." Three flashes, "You too." But that was before, when I could still see myself in the mirror from 9 steps.
Paola Peretti's editor at Hot Key Books is Emma Mathewson, and I was keen to find out from her what it was about the distance between me and the cherry tree that first drew her to the story. Emma, welcome to Read On.
Hello.
What was it that first grabbed you about the story?
There was an immediate warmth about Paola's storytelling, and she actually writes in a deceptively simple way, which packs an awful lot of punch. But essentially what was also very important for us, that Paola was writing about a young girl, Mafalda, who has her own specific challenge, that of sight loss. But it was very important for us too that to hear that Paola herself was writing partly from her own experience, which gave enormous credibility for us for the book.
It is being marketed as a book for children over here, but it is, I think, a very accessible book for adults as well. It's got that magical side to the realism of her losing her sight loss that makes it a very engaging story, not a misery memoir in any sense of the word.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And this book is actually a book full of hope. I actually think that almost all excellent books for children have a wider readership than, in quotes, just for children. And all excellent children's books will be admired and loved by adults as well. And this book, we think, falls into that category because there are so many layers to it that a child can enjoy and understand and appreciate, but that also adults will have much to take away from as well. And so although nominally this book is for 9 to 11-year-old children, we do think that adults could enjoy and take so much from it.
Yes, and it makes reference to books such as The Little Prince and The Baron and the Trees, both of which arguably are seen as children's books, but have just as huge an appeal to grown-up readers who will take them through life with them.
Absolutely, and I think those are two classic examples which are beautifully referenced within the book.
Do you specialise in European literature at Hot Key Books, or do you publish books from all over the world?
It's fair to say that currently the majority of our books are written primarily in the English language. However, we are always on the lookout for diverse voices, and that includes, of course, books in translation. One of the other exciting things about Paola's book was that when we first received the book from her agent, we had 39 pages in English as a sample translation, but also the full book in Italian. We were very lucky here at Hot Key because, well, I felt very lucky because I speak Italian, could go instantly directly to the original text. We also have a wonderful colleague in the rights department who is Italian and therefore speaks Italian extremely well. What that meant was that we didn't have to rely on a sample translation. We could go directly to the book and read Paola's original writing and really get a sense of the book. So that was very exciting for us.
Now, I've just been interviewing Denise Muir, who translated the book. Did you have much to do with the day-to-day translation of the book, or did you leave that very much to Denise and Paola, and then you looked at the finished article and said, yes, that's wonderful?
Denise's translation from the very first was absolutely excellent. Denise and I worked together on it, and then any further questions we had, we would put to Paola. But my role was very much working a little bit with Denise, just refining a few areas here and there. In this instance, whereas sometimes translations can feel quite... They can feel occasionally a bit clunky or as if they are translated. I was very, very keen that this was a book that should read with a natural rhythm. And that's what Denise managed extremely well. I was very happy with that.
One of the real strengths of the book is just how three-dimensional the characters are. They all have their own voices and they're incredibly engaging. Even the ones who leave you with your head in your hands going, no, you've just got to accept her sight loss.
I think that's true. And I think what's very interesting about this book is the relation of between Mafalda, the other child characters, and the other adult characters. Mafalda's parents are actually quite minimal within the book. And the adult characters who are more important to her in this book is the adult character is Estella, the Romanian caretaker at her school. And of course, the friend that she makes through her loss of sight, Filippo, the rather naughty boy in the neighbourhood. But I think what is very interesting as a child reader, and what is important for me as a publisher to publish this book, that as a child, at some point in one's life, one has to realise that there are challenges that you cannot, your parents cannot just magic away, that there are some challenges that life might not be fair, but these are the cards you've been dealt, and you're going to have to deal with them and find a way within yourself to deal with them. And this is what Mafalda is trying and failing at first and then trying again to find her own ways of dealing with what is becoming, will become eventual complete loss of sight. That's what's so extraordinary for me and gives that multi-layeredness that you've just mentioned.
Yes, and that help might come from unexpected places. There's a point at which you have to step away from your parents and find who else you can rely upon.
I think that's right. And Paola speaks very movingly about her parents, as her own parents are so loving and so protective, it's hard for them to step away. So she actually realised herself as a child she needed to sort of, in a way, protect them and just find her own ways of working out her solution to her problem. And in the book, you know, Mafalda wonderfully tries to call on the characters in literature, Cosimo, from the book that she loves. And actually, as in real life, Cosimo doesn't help her. And this is one of her failed experiments to find a solution. But she actually finds a solution in real life people, in Estella, the caretakers we've mentioned, and in Filippo, the boy from the neighbourhood.
And in focusing on what she can achieve rather than seeing only on what she's lost.
Absolutely. Cup half full rather than half empty. Yes, yes.
Well, I think that's it's a vital lesson that anybody with progressive sight loss has to learn eventually. It takes some of us longer than others. It's why I think this is such an important book and why actually I'd recommend anybody who has a diagnosis of progressive sight loss to pick it up and read it. Do you think we're entering a more enlightened age of books about diversity and disability being published? Because for a long time it's felt to many of us that publishing just wasn't interested in disability.
I think that's right, and I think there is a very welcome drive now to be more diverse in the books that we publish and the characters and the writers that we publish. I think that there is a great need for empathy within children and for children to be introduced to characters, even within the pages of a book, who are in different circumstances and settings to their own, so that if by any chance these same children, these same readers do come across a character in real life who has a similar situation, they will feel more comfortable in reassuring them perhaps or supporting them because they've already met them before within the pages of a book.
Well, I think that's a wonderful message to end on. Emma Mathewson, thank you very much for joining me in the Read On studio.
Oh, thank you for having me.
RNIB, supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB newsagent service, which delivers the latest news, magazines and stories in a range of accessible formats to people with sight loss, is now free for under 16s. Reading can make the world of difference, and it's vital that all blind and partially sighted children can access the same content as their sighted peers in a fun and creative way. Current titles in the RNIB newsagent service include BBC Horrible Histories, First News, Aquila, National Geographic and RNIB Blast Off. Formats include audio CD or USB, email or Braille. To register for RNIB newsagent, please call our helpline on 0303 123 9999 or email us at helpline@rnib.org.uk.
I'm Tibor Fisher, and this is my story, Listed for Trial.
This is Julian Barnes, and I'm reading a story I wrote called The Things You Know.
Hello, my name's Peter Robinson, and I write a series of books featuring DCI Alan Banks.
This is Doris Lessing, and I'm reading a chapter from my novel, The Sweetest Dream.
Hello, I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and I'm reading Sandy and Her Beautiful Sisters, A Modern Fairy Tale, by Antonia Fraser.
Here is the news, by Richard Baker, read by the author.
I'm Bill Bryson, reading from my book, One Summer, America, 1927.
Hello, this is Faye Weldon, and this is one of my stories. It's called Eyes in the Dark.
This morning I had my usual breakfast of toast and marmalade, which I have to have because that's Paddington's favourite.
This is Julia Donaldson, and you're listening to Talking Books.
My name is Jim Broadbent, and I'm delighted to be reading for Talking Books.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, bringing you some great books for the school summer holidays. Here's author and listener N.B. Dixon to tell us about a book that still resonates with her.
Hello, this is N.B. Dixon, and here is my review of the audiobook Inkheart, written by Cornelia Funke and beautifully read by Lynn Redgrave. It's available from both Audible and the RNIB Talking Books Library, and in both cases, the narrator is the same.
I'm sure it must be very comfortable sleeping with a hard, rectangular thing like that under your head. Her father had teased her the first time he found a book under her pillow. Go on, admit it. The book whispers its story to you at night.
Sometimes, yes, Maggie had said. But it only works for children. Which made Mo tweak her nose. Mo. Maggie had never called her father anything else.
Have you ever wished you could meet your favourite characters from your favourite books? Mo and his daughter Maggie possess just such a gift. Simply by reading aloud, they can bring any character from any story into their world. However, such a gift always comes with a price. When Mo inadvertently reads an evil man into his own world, the man in question has no plans for returning to his story. Mo and his daughter Maggie are forced to go on the run, but the evil Capricorn is determined to hunt them down. He has dark plans for them and the world in which he now finds himself.
That night, when so much began and so many things changed forever, Maggie had one of her favourite books under her pillow, and since the rain wouldn't let her sleep, she sat up, rubbed the drowsiness from her eyes, and took it out. Its pages rustled promisingly when she opened it. Maggie thought this first whisper sounded a little different from one book to another, depending on whether or not she already knew the story it was going to tell her. But she needed light. She had a box of matches hidden in the drawer of her bedside table. Mo had forbidden her to light candles at night. He didn't like fire. Fire devours books, he always said. But she was 12 years old. She surely could be trusted to keep an eye on a couple of candle flames.
Like many great books written for children, Inkheart can also be appreciated by adults. It's a beautifully written story, and I hope it will become a classic one day if it hasn't already. One of the things I love the most about Inkheart is the imagery. Normally, any kind of visual imagery leaves me pretty unmoved. I generally tend to switch off. But in the case of Inkheart, the author was literally able to hold my attention from the opening lines. I remember she describes the written word as the labyrinth of printed letters. That has always stayed with me. And my all-time favourite quote comes from Inkheart. There's a sign on the hero's workshop door that says, "Some books should be tasted, others devoured, but only a few should be chewed and digested thoroughly." And I just thought that was an absolutely fantastic quote. But for the story itself, Inkheart is dark and exciting, and there are some absolutely unforgettable characters in it. It's just an amazing story. I really can't praise it highly enough. But for anyone who loves fantasy and adventure, no matter your age, you should read Inkheart. Its two sequels, Inkspell and Inkdeath, are also available from both Audible and RNIB Talking Books.
Meggie loved to read by candlelight. She had 5 candlesticks on the windowsill, and she was just holding the lighted match to one of the black wicks when she heard footsteps outside. She blew out the match in alarm. Oh, how well she remembered it, even many years later, and knelt to look out of the window, which was wet with rain. Then she saw him. The rain cast a kind of pallor on the darkness, and the stranger was little more than a shadow. Only his face gleamed white as he looked up at Meggie. His hair clung to his wet forehead. The rain was falling on him, but he ignored it. He stood there, motionless, arms crossed over his chest, as if that might at least warm him a little. And he kept on staring at the house.
Lynn Redgrave narrating Inkheart by Cornelia Funke. Thanks to N.B. Dixon. All the books in the Inkheart trilogy are available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library. The first Inkheart is TB16312. And don't forget, if you'd like to record a book review or have an educating read suggestion, you can do so by dropping us a line via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. You're listening to Read On. To coincide with the school summer holidays, the RNIB Library has launched its annual Summer Reading Challenge. Among the 29 specially selected titles, there are books for all reading ages and abilities, including some giant print books with some giant illustrations that were commissioned by the team at Guide Dogs. And, of course, there's a great selection of talking books, including this one for readers 5 and above, Superdog. It's written by Pamela Butchett and narrated by Avita Jay.
One time, a dog got into the playground at morning break. At first, we all thought it was a wolf because it was huge. But Megan McNally said that it was definitely not a wolf because wolves are wild, so they don't wear collars. The dog ran around the playground for ages and everyone screamed whenever it came near them. But then Mr. Harris, the deputy head, came out to see what all the screaming was about and the dog disappeared. Everyone was talking about the playground dog when we went back to the classroom, and no one could concentrate on their French like Miss Riley wanted us to do because we were all thinking about the dog. Then Bobby Henderson gasped and pointed out of the window and shouted, "He's back!" But by the time we all got out of our seats and ran up to the window to see, Playground Dog had disappeared again. Irfan Baxter said that it was a bit weird how both times the dog had disappeared so quickly and that maybe Playground Dog had powers. That's when we all realised that this was no ordinary dog. At lunchtime, loads of people spotted Playground Dog in weird places, and Megan McNally even thought she spotted his tail on the roof. That's when Irfan said, "I can't believe it! That's how he keeps disappearing! Playground Dog can fly!"
Superdog by Pamela Butchett is TB24484, and it's also available in Braille and giant print. And for slightly older readers, why not try Do You Speak Chocolate by Kaz Lester, which is also narrated by Avita Jay.
I can remember exactly the day I met Nadima. It was the day I got my 3 big brothers to wear skirts to school. Yes, seriously. It was summer and boiling hot, and everyone was sweating away in long black trousers. So I'd started this petition to wear shorts, and I wanted to get the entire school to sign it. I was launching the campaign by wearing my PE shorts to school, so I asked my mate Lily if she'd wear hers too, and she said yes. Then she went and told her mate Cara, and Cara told her not to because she'd get into trouble. So the night before, right at the very last minute, Lily texted me. "Sorry, Jazz, not wearing shorts to school. Lil, kiss." "Seriously?" "Thanks a bundle, Lil." It wasn't like her to do that to me, but I might have guessed Cara would stick her big nose in. So then I'd had the brilliant idea of getting the brothers to wear skirts. They thought it'd be a laugh. Me too. Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. That morning, as we all piled out of Mum's car at school, everyone was pointing and laughing. To be fair, the brothers looked hilarious. Miniskirts are so not the right fashion statement for any of them. They just don't have the legs. Or the shoes.
"I want to die now," moaned Dan, tugging at his skirt.
"I am going straight to the toilets to change," announced Gus. Technically, Gus is the youngest big bro, but he's going to be the biggest. He's only in year 9, but he's as tall as Dan already, and Dan's in year 11. Matt's my oldest big bro. He's in the sixth form. He stood glaring at me in the drop-off area and muttered,
"I look ridiculous."
He was right. He's 6'2" and his skirt barely covered his boxers. "Man up, big bro," I laughed, slapping him on the back.
Do You Speak Chocolate by Kaz Lester is available in Braille, giant print and as TB24487. For a full list of the wonderful titles on this year's Summer Reading Challenge, go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.